The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Thanks for listening to this Takeaway podcast. On the Friday before the 2016 election, we ran this special hour, Shaky Ground, exploring the global turbulence of 2016. And now that we're in the aftermath of an event we all feel, we feel it's more important than ever to play it again. So without further ado. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what has this whole 10 months of show business, broken records, political locker room talk, evolving language, fodder for comedians, and alarm bells for the rest of us, what has it all meant? This hour, we pose the question, in this strange, molten movement we're seeing in the global economy, politics, our understanding of history right now, the increasingly molten planet, more about that later, Europe breaking apart, the Middle East, a landscape increasingly of rubble from Yemen to Libya. Is this just a blip or what? Hey, I'm not trying to ruin your weekend or anything, but listen here to former Supreme Court Justice David Souter in 2012, talking about a time of turbulence, sometime in a seemingly far distant future, and the consequences of that.
When problems are not addressed, and when the problems get bad enough, some one person will come forward and say, "Give me total power and I will solve this problem." And we and the government will in effect say, "Take the ball and run with it. Do what you have to do." That is the way democracy dies.
Okay, you may have seen those comments of former Justice David Souter online recently. They've been passed around as people try to make sense of a moment when things that recently felt like solid ground are drifting. Hey, folks, the Cubs won the World Series for the first time in 108 years. That's got UFO and singularity written all over it, right? But I'm serious here. And don't tell me you are not feeling something different in 2016.
This is Cheyenne. I'm calling from Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania. As a member of Generation X, I learned to be cynical and jaded some 25 years ago. But this year has brought far more shock, fear, and disappointment than any I can recall.
This is Sandy Krelovec from Canby, Oregon. It really feels like everything's falling apart. People are unhappy with how the governments are dealing with local and world issues. But I feel that the government should be the people. I get the frustration, but I really don't understand quite how to help us all come together and create a calmer and happy world.
My name is Eric Hamill. I live in Philadelphia. One of the single things I could say about 2016 is that election results all over the world suggest that capitalist rule is entering a crisis of legitimacy.
Just call us at the usual place, 877-8-MY-TAKE. No turbulence there. So is Trump what David Souter predicted? Are the problems that great that we would hand the keys to the kingdom to a neo-king? Like Britain's just up and decided to leave the EU, or the Philippines deciding to let a guy who believes in vigilante justice for drug offenders lead their nation of 100 million people? President Rodrigo Duterte? There's a character for the turbulent 2016s. But you've also got all the issues that haven't been decided on by a vote. There's police violence against African Americans, the largest mass migration of refugees and migrants since World War II, 65 million displaced people. There's a law firm in Panama that opened its files to reveal a secret club of world leaders ripping off the rest of us and threatening the international financial system. Remember that story? You've got a U.S. bank setting up phony accounts for customers and then charging them. And 2016 saw the first American government relocation of climate refugees moved north away from the creeping shores of the Gulf of Mexico. Enough alarmist radio hosts. What does a real historian say about all of this?
The kinds of things that we're seeing today, these are not problems that have roots dating back a few months or a few years. You know, I think that many of them trace themselves back several decades. But, you know, like we know with fruit and vegetables, sometimes it takes time for things to come to fruition, bad things as well as good.
That's Peter Frankopan, a historian at Oxford University and the author most recently of The Silk Roads, A New History of the World. He's into the long game of history and argues that what we're currently seeing and feeling are deep rumbles from an unstoppable shift in power from the West back to the East. What we think of as Western civilization in this view may be the blip in the long game.
Well, I think we are clearly seeing a world in transition. In the United States, the presidential election is obviously a key factor in what the direction the US will take. But here in Britain, we've had a trauma of Brexit, where the political discussion has seen a country really at snapping point into two halves. But in other parts of the world, that transition means the rise of ideologies, the rise of China and its economy, maybe overheating Chinese economy. Climate change is still an important factor in what life is going to look like for many millions, if not billions, of people living on this earth. And so that world of transition from the Pacific coast of China right the way through the Eurasian landmass, through Africa, and in both continents of the Americas, looks like this is a fairly pivotal moment in history.
Are people feeling that turbulence, that change, as anxiety, or are they seeing it as opportunity?
Well, I think we're wired as an animal to be very fearful of uncertainty. And I think that what scares so many people right now is that there seem to be so many moving parts, whether that's a refugee crisis in the Middle East, whether that's the future of the European Union, whether it's the US and its economy and its political systems, whether China's rise and its growing of muscles and ambitions and expansion of Chinese horizons, what that might mean for us. And at these times in history as well, it's quite usual for prophets to appear who are able to explain what the problems are and to offer some kinds of solutions. And I think that with the US presidential election, that is part of the appeal that Trump clearly has to a significant proportion of the American voting electorate. The appearance of a figure who is able to diagnose and do that is something which we see many, many times in history.
Is anxiety, the identification of anxiety, the same as understanding change?
Well, I think in many cases in the developed world, those anxieties are well placed, because for those of us living in developed economies, I think it's fair to say that we've had a pretty good 300-year run, and that sunshine, the rays, are just a little bit less strong than they used to be, and the shadows grow a little bit longer, and the mathematical reality, I think, is that this big shift in power away from, certainly from Western Europe, but back towards the center of Asia, the pivot, is something that you can't stand in the way of these big waves of change, and you can't stop it.
Do you view the United States and the success of the United States as the ultimate European success story in the Western Hemisphere, or is it something fundamentally different?
Well, if I was talking 6 months ago, I'd have said that what the United States has proved extraordinarily able to do has been to integrate and assimilate people to create a single identity of what it means to be an American. And to some extent, it seems that the debate in the election upcoming is precisely about what does that even mean right now? Can you be a Muslim American? Can you be a Hispanic or a Black American? Where is your voice heard if you're not part of some kind of elite? And those kinds of questions are rooted into the obvious truth, I think, which is statistical, of rising levels of inequality. And when you have those rising levels of inequality, the gold dust of identity starts to fade. And what it means to have felt proud once, it's very hard to keep that together. And we have this here, certainly in Europe. Once you take the genie out of the bottle and you allow the normalization of language, of mudslinging and of denigration of people's race, color, religions, and so on, or political views, then it's much, much harder to provide that glue that sticks people together. And the US has had an incredible success rate over the last 200 or 300 years in being able to provide a vision that the American dream is alive for everybody. And this is a crucial point, I think, to see whether that it remains to be the case in the rest of the 21st century. Are the political powers, are the levels of tax equalizations able to exist and modify that allow people who are born under any circumstances to be able to reach, let's say, the White House or become an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley?
At the end of this century, will France be irrelevant? Will Europe be dead? Will the idea of a European Union be meaningful in the way that it was at the beginning of this century?
We live in a ultra-fragile world. 100 years ago, Franz Ferdinand was shot on the streets of Sarajevo, and that one man's death led to a world war. 15 years ago, on 9/11, the actions of 19 men and one guy in a cave transformed the way in which we see Islam, transformed the way in which we engage in the Middle East. And these single events can prove that the fragility of our world, but also of the folly of trying to cast forward. But I think, as a historian, what I would say is that not so very long ago, Western Europe was absolutely peripheral. Everything that went on in the world happened in the heart of Asia. And I say that because Western Europe was at the wrong end of these great trading networks called the Silk Roads that connected trading markets in China right the way through with Central Asia, places like Samarkand and Isfahan, and eventually through to Damascus, Baghdad, Constantinople, and Venice. We forget that is the wheel on which the world has always turned. and Western Europe, France, Germany, Britain, was all at the wrong end of things. That changed around about 1500 when Columbus sailed across the Atlantic and when Vasco da Gama went round the southern tip of Africa, and suddenly the world's continents were connected to each other for the first time. And that then created a world where Western Europe was able to use its advantages to suck in assets and cash and minerals from the Inca and the Aztec world and redistribute them and to build trading positions in Asia. And we've seen over the last 100 years all of that start to fall away, to the point that now, you know, Western European empire was replaced by an American empire, if we can call it that. So Western Europe was never really central until really, really recently. But, you know, we've had a good run at it. But I think that the rising powers elsewhere in the world, let's say in China or across Asia, feel that their children will live in a better world than they live in today. We here in the West, I think, are very concerned that our children are going to grow up in a worse world. There's a reality that underpins that.
Well, then, finally, given that narrative that you've described, is Western democracy essential to the changes that you envision in the next 100 years?
Well, I think it's no surprise that in all of these countries running east from Venice, from Turkey through Russia, Central Asian republics, Iran, China and so on, the structure of how the political life looks is very different to how it looks in the West, where democracy, human rights are prioritized. These countries which are planning for the future over the long term don't have the same obstacles in their way. That's not to endorse them in any way. That's not to give a carte blanche to their leaders or to say that this is a preferable system, because I know where I'd rather be living. But I think that it's increasingly apparent to us that having lots of voices around the table to try to reach a decision is a difficult way to run governments. And countries like China, whose current economic cycle runs out to 2049, doesn't have to worry about the same kinds of pressures that we do in the Houses of Parliament and in Congress and so on. And that's fine if Congress and if Parliament consistently make good and correct decisions. What's harder is when you have a disjointed, fractured democratic tradition, or position rather, where extremist parties, in the rise of the right across many countries in Europe right now is a real problem, are demanding a voice at the table, and the ways in, that they're talking about, particularly about foreigners, starts to change how we perceive ourselves as well. So I hope that democracy isn't under threat, but I think we are right to confront the fact that this is a period of a bit of soul-searching about how we make decisions.
Peter Frankopan is a historian at Oxford University, author of The Silk Roads, A New History of the World.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
My name is Matthew McManus. I'm 26. I'm an aircraft mechanic.
Matthew McManus is one of the voters featured in our American Voter Project series. He's from the working class community type, one of the 15 community types in the American Communities Project that we've been featuring all this week on The Takeaway, and that you can go hear for yourself at thetakeaway.org. His community, though, is literally trembling above and below the surface.
I live in Harrison County, West Virginia, in a town called Bridgeport. It's a small town, about 8,000 people, mostly white middle class. We are nestled in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. It's a very hilly, mountainous area. Everything is covered in trees, and there's no flat land here. I was born and raised in Huntington, West Virginia, a couple hours south on the West Virginia-Ohio-Kentucky border. I did the traditional four-year college thing after high school. Did that for a couple years, and that really wasn't working out. So I moved up here. There's a trade school up at the airport that I got certified to work on aircraft there. Locally, we have a problem retaining young people, particularly people like my age. There's not necessarily the jobs here for us. A lot of people that I went to college with, they got a four-year degree. They did everything they were supposed to do. And then they get out, and there's not a job there for them. Countless people I know from college either had to move out of state to get a job in their field, or they're working construction or in a call center or at a daycare. 5 or 6 years ago, there was a huge influx of jobs with fracking, oil and gas workers. They brought in a lot of guys from out of state, and they employed a lot of people locally. And that was great for a few years, but there's only so many wells that can be drilled and so many miles of pipeline that can be laid before companies have to start laying off. We used to have a lot of factories, steel mills, heavy industry manufacturing, but that's all been kind of phased out over the last 10 or 20 years. My grandfather graduated high school and worked in an aluminum factory his entire life. He's done very well for himself, but you can't find jobs like that anymore. I think if we had a generation of skilled workers, people that learn trades, machinists, pipe fitters, welders, and electricians, people that can actually produce things for the economy, I think that would encourage companies to invest in West Virginia. They could say, look, We have an educated workforce. These are skilled workers. We should bring our business here. That's what this state needs.
McManus's account of being on the wrong end of globalization makes perfect sense to economist Branko Milanovic, who talked about all this in his 1998 book, Income, Inequality, and Poverty During the Transition from Planned to Market Economy. This year, he gave us some more to think about in Global Inequality, A New Approach for the Age of Globalization. Milanovic says in the economic race right now, the global 1% is winning, followed by the Asian middle class, who doubled their incomes between 1998 and 2011. The Western middle class has been stuck in the pit stop for most of this century. In the U.S., you have the top 10% earning nearly nine times as much income as the bottom 90%.
Well, I think there is a turbulence, but I would say it's more turbulence in sense of national inequalities, because in many countries, actually, national inequalities have gone up. So I think there is a greater awareness of that. And what brought it to a head is the movements in Europe and the U.S., essentially Brexit, populists in Europe, and, of course, Trump in the United States. Now, is it a legitimate grievance? You know, it is legitimate to the extent that these middle classes in rich countries have not seen much real growth. So in that sense, it is not made up grievance. It does exist. Now, but would the policies that they advocate help their position? That's what I'm not actually quite sure. I believe that it would be the reverse.
Has free trade exacerbated the inequality trajectories, or are they something else entirely?
Well, I believe that the free trade did exacerbate that. Now, the free trade or globalization is not alone to have done that. First, technological change that we have seen, which has been dramatically fast in the last 30 years, actually has replaced many jobs. Some of that would have happened without globalization, but globalization kind of accelerated that change. And then economic policies changed as well. You know, taxation rates went down, inheritance taxes went down. So there were lots of changes that happened simultaneously.
Is the turbulence associated with globalization a getting used to change kind of factor, and that it will settle down as it becomes the status quo? Or is it pressure building to some breaking point?
I don't think it's a pressure building to a breaking point, but I think that it would actually subside and things will get more, quote-unquote, normalized. But it is going to take time. You know, if you look back in the past, we have had turbulences of the similar nature before. And eventually, of course, people who lose jobs and who cannot acquire new skills or who are too old for that, eventually they fade out. You know, the next generation comes in. Now, the problem is that with high inequality, it could actually happen that you create some kind of a permanent underclass who does have trouble really sort of adjusting to the new world. So I think that's where the danger is.
It also seems as though globalization puts tension on the whole idea of the nation state, in that the state is blamed for things that happen as a result of multinational dynamics. Is there tension and turbulence associated with the nation state because of globalization?
I absolutely think so. I think you actually put it very well. What is happening is that our incomes are more and more determined by what happens really elsewhere in the world. You know, when you have a problem, when you lose your job, your wages don't go up, you complain to the national government, but the national government has fewer tools to help you than it had 30 years ago.
Is this idea of unfettered global capitalism coming to an end, and that what was thought of as the new normal is going to actually be a golden age that recedes into the past?
The optimistic scenario is that basically here is the bump. The bump is going to last for a while. This is not going to be exactly the same as it was between 2000 and 2007. But, you know, after a while, things will go back to normal. And then we will again have the period of, you know, high growth and financialization of that. I don't think it's going to happen exactly like that, because we see from history there are bumps which happen. But these bumps move us in one direction or the other direction. So we are not going to really replicate exactly what happened before the crisis. But it doesn't mean that globalization is at the end. You know, globalization can continue, but look differently from the way that it looked before. Because if you look at actually how people were and what people were writing like in the year 2000 and so on, it really seemed that basically now all the problems have been solved. We know how to manage not only the economies but the world. There will be all these magical and extraordinary things happening, you know, and definitely this is gone.
Branko, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John. Thanks a lot for having me.
Branko Milanovic is an economist at the City University of New York, author most recently of Global Inequality, A New Approach for the Age of Globalization.
The Takeaway is supported by American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Think of the last conversation you've had about race this year. Anything different?
I'm here at the Academy Awards, otherwise known as the White People's Choice Awards. You realize if they nominated host, I wouldn't even get this job.
How much of the turbulence of this year is related to race? Think of how powerfully writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates have busted open the way we talk about police violence against African Americans or the violence against police. Nell Irvin Painter is the Edwards Professor of American History Emerita at Princeton University and author of The History of White People. Painter sees America's racial conversation bubbling over from what she describes as an intensive verbal fracking this year, a probing beneath the surface.
I sort of see a stream of racism, xenophobia, sexism, misogyny, a stream of bad things. Maybe it's a mixed up stream, and maybe it's a tangle of ropes. And it's as if Trump has sort of drilled down and pierced the crust over this that usually keeps it down and silent and out of good manners, sort of pierced that. And then it's all come sort of flowing up, and we're hearing the kind of nastiness that we thought we'd never hear again, like anti-Semitism. So very often what I've been hearing is, oh, this has never happened before. How could this happen? This is not the America I know. Where did this come from? I don't understand. I said, listen, this has been here. This has been here. And somebody just poked it and brought it up closer to the surface or through the surface. So, for instance, you can see a whole history of responses to what white supremacy sees as provocations. So the biggest provocation is the black president.
So the notion that President Obama is a remedy is incomplete without understanding that, in fact, he's at least as powerful a provocation.
Well, he's a remedy for people who voted for him, which is a majority of the voters, twice. But in terms of white supremacy, and that's what I was talking about, in terms of white supremacy, he's a provocation. And in terms of white supremacy, Donald Trump is the remedy.
How are people who are angry, who are supporters of Trump, who feel as though their declining expectations are the result of someone taking something from them, to resolve the understandable feeling of nobody likes anything taken from them or losing out with racism?
Well, they are losing something, and that is a kind of perceived immunity to having to think about race or having to think about racism. So you can go about your life very happily thinking of yourself merely as an individual. And seeing yourself as an American with a race probably feels like an insult or an injury. That said, if we are going to have a real democracy, we're going to have to understand that all of us are in this together, and that it's not some people who get to not have race and other people who have to bear all the burdens of race.
Nell Painter, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nell Irvin Painter is Edwards Professor of American History Emerita at Princeton University and author of The History of White People.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. And American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com. The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
To some people in the world, this sound is turbulence right now.
I live right next to the water. When the waves come, they're usually way over the seawalls that a lot of people have built across the seashore. And so as it is becoming more frequent, there's this increasing worry amongst a lot of us that our islands are just going to disappear.
19-year-old Selena Lem is watching her home quietly disappear. She lives in the Marshall Islands, a place that may soon be gone. And she spoke to us about how she is saying goodbye.
I would leave memories, my grandparent, the woman I grew up with, my culture, my home.
Climate change and sea level rise cannot be stopped. And so, like humans have done for thousands of years, Selena will pack up what she can carry and move on.
Memories in my head, seashells, handicrafts, photos that my grandpa really made sure to save. It'd be very nice to look at them so many years from now on.
Selena Lem says goodbye, and this year the U.S. government resettled its first domestic climate refugees.
You know, this land, this island has been our home for about 7 or 8 generations.
The land's sinking, eroding. There's nothing really left.
These are the Brune brothers, residents of the Isle of Jean de Charles, the historical homeland for the Biloxi, Chitimacha, Choctaw tribe of Native Americans. Their home nearly gone, a 21st century trail of tears as they move north, away from their island in the Gulf of Mexico, with $48 million in funds from the federal government. The sound of those collective goodbyes, the mass migration of people faced with irrevocable change is real around the world. And this sound is real, too.
Donald thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I think it's real.
I did not.
Science is real.
I do not say that.
And I think it's important that we grip this and deal with it.
What we choose to deal with and what we choose to ignore just might define the history of this century. These are the stark choices of turbulent times. Climate change is just one example. We could choose many more. We've talked about many of them already this hour. The campaign has mentioned them in contradictions and angry changes and recriminations that may hit buttons, but get us no closer to truth.
You're saying liberals use these numbers, they use this sort of magic math. This is the FBI statistics. They're not a liberal organization.
No, people feel more threatened.
Yes, but the facts don't support it.
I'll go with how people feel, and I'll let you go with the theoreticians.
And so with that in mind, do we even have the language to describe what's going on around us? Writers like Tom Friedman are convinced that we do, but he also says it's harder and harder for all of us to get on the same page.
We're really seeing a new divide in the world emerge. The main geopolitical divide is no longer east-west, north-south, communist-capitalist. Really, the main geopolitical divide now is going to be between the world of order and the world of disorder. And you're already seeing that take shape with the Mediterranean now one of the main dividing lines.
Friedman tells us that close to 80% of refugees in Europe are from Africa, and many of them driven as a result of changing climate, many more from other manifestations of that divide he talks about in global unrest, war, intolerance, poverty. Coming up, what are facts in a turbulent time? How easy is it to get lost in fear and emotion when we just want something or someone to fix it all? How does this all feel in your world?
Hi, this is Lisa from rural Ohio. I live in a cul-de-sac outside of town of about 18,000 people. The unique thing about our neighborhood is that all of us were friends or acquaintances in high school. We went away to college and then came back to our hometown to raise a family. But for the first time ever, neighbors are not speaking to each other. Political signs adorn yards, and the divide is real. When discussions go to politics, it almost always comes around to the Second Amendment. I watch my best friend since seventh grade, mother of two, nurse, and fellow lover of humanity, taking target practice in her backyard on weekends so that she can obtain her carry permit before the election. I'm completely saddened that this election has turned my best friends to embrace fear and loathing and not love of one another. I'm wondering how long it will take for our neighborhood to heal.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or share your thoughts with us on Facebook at The Takeaway. So, just forget facts, folks, unless you can walk on water. The liquid mush of civic discourse these days goes way beyond joke master Stephen Colbert's celebrated truthiness. Peter Pomerantsev, a senior fellow at the Legatum Institute in London, is the author of the reassuring book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. Let's listen to him.
There's an underlying issue here, which is more to do with the way we see ourselves as a society and how we see our future. Because if you think about it, you know, facts aren't actually very pleasant. You know, facts tell us basically we're going to die. We're nothing as good looking as we think we are. We're probably nothing as rich as we think we are. Probably, you know, going to be poorer than our parents. And that our countries in the West essentially, especially, are in decline. And the only time you really need facts is when you've got a clear, coherent and very tangible future to aim for. When you're building a new country or something, or there are reforms that you have to achieve. But what's very noticeable in all the politics in America and Europe is we don't really have an idea of the future anymore. And when you don't, then why would, you know, if a politician isn't articulating where he wants society to, or she wants society to get to, then why would they use facts and kind of, you know, these weird nostalgias take over and, you know, they're being peddled by politicians all across the world at the moment.
Who's good at manipulating facts and denying facts that even people who are listening to the lie know are true?
Well, listen, look, politicians have always lied. That's always been part of their job, and we shouldn't be surprised when they lie. We should assume that as journalists and challenge them. What's different is the attitude to lying. So let's move away from America. Let's have a look at Vladimir Putin. You know, when Vladimir Putin goes on international TV and kind of with a smirk tells the world there are no Russian soldiers in Crimea, when everybody knows there are, and he knows that everybody knows there are, well, he's sort of saying, you know, I don't care about the facts. Yeah, I'm going to do whatever I want. And he's almost provoking Western politicians to say, hey, Vladimir, you're lying. So he can point back and say, well, you lie too. Everyone lies. It's normal. Get over it. You know, that's a very different approach to, let's say, without getting into a big, you know, debate about Iraq, where, you know, clearly some disinformation was used to launch that war. But there the politicians were trying to convince people that their lies were real. Now they're kind of openly saying, yeah, we lie. What are you going to do about it? Big deal. Who cares?
Can countries go to war over a different understanding of the facts?
Well, they go to war for lots of reasons. But listen, I think there's something built into information revolutions. So go back to the start of the 20th century. Information revolutions, you know, they always had the promise of, you know, great reform and truth-telling. But actually, when they start, they often let the devils in. So, you know, start of the 20th century, the appearance of radio and cinema empowers totalitarian ideologies. Going further back, the appearance of print helped fuel sort of, you know, anti-Semitism and helped fuel sort of conspiracy theories and helped really, I know it's a big thing to say, but kind of helped inspire or set the scene for the 30 Years' War in Europe. So information revolutions, they bring great promise, but they also bring great disruption in a negative sense as well. And often the sort of the people peddling hate speech and violence are the ones that take advantage of them first. And it takes a bit of time for society to kind of, you know, set the rules again. You know, like we did after the Nuremberg trials, after the Second World War, when, you know, or after McCarthyism in the US. I mean, again, the appearance of television really inspires McCarthyism in the US. So I think information revolutions, they're very dangerous periods, and we shouldn't forget about that. They do tend to bring out some of the darker forces in humanity.
Finally, is there a way to turn on the lights and find the facts and then realize where we are?
Well, I mean, to be honest, historically, the process has been incredibly traumatic. I mean, the last time this happened is, I think the first half of the 20th century, and it ended up with the Second World War. And people only really came to their senses after, you know, the awfulness of World War II. And that's when, not in America, but certainly in the West, I mean, in Europe, you have ideas coming in like sort of hate speech and the need for accuracy in media and some sort of regulation over media. Very light regulation. It's still a free media, but you can't, you know, in Britain we have something called Ofcom, I know, which is a crazy idea for the US, but it tells if TV channels, are biased or inaccurate, and if they do hate speech or incitement to violence, they do get sanctioned. That's something that came in after the Second World War in many ways. This idea that after the Nuremberg trials, that we have to have some sort of rules of the game. A lot of that was just sort of the gatekeepers, editors and politicians, sort of almost agreeing amongst themselves that for the good of society, we shouldn't do this. And remember, John McCain did this. Remember when these conspiracy theories started about Obama during when he was running against McCain? McCain said, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to peddle conspiracy theories. That's not the sort of political discourse we have. That's been broken now with your latest election round. And now forms of thinking, conspiracy, hate speech, dog whistling towards racism, that has moved from the fringes into the mainstream. I really hope that, we can come to our senses before some terrible cataclysm, because historically what starts off as words, hateful language, then ends up in real violence.
Peter Pomerantsev is a senior fellow at the Legatum Institute in London and the author of Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. It reminds me of a conversation I had this year with writer Don DeLillo that I still can't get out of my mind. Forget facts. When I asked him about the 2016 election, DeLillo said quietly, hey, forget the future.
I don't know that people have a great faith in future. It's supposed to be part of an American religion to believe in the future. But I'm not sure it has maintained the same strength. I think something has changed in this country. I don't know that we believe in America's ability to continue to advance in so many different areas and to continue the global leadership that we've had since World War II. I also think that our view of ourselves is going to be not quite as strong and positive as it was for decades after World War II. What are we faced with immediately? We're faced with the claims of a presidential candidate that surpasses anything in our living experience. What will Trump tell us tomorrow and the day after? And how will it affect our sense of ourselves as Americans? And I think that's as much as I care to say about that.
Coming up, democracy in a post-Trump or post-Clinton world. That's next.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity brain training with games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. From scientists and game designers exploring new ways to research human cognition. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
So we began this hour with that chilling prediction from former Supreme Court Justice David Souter. And now let's take that on. What do you think? Can democracy withstand all this turbulence when voters might be tempted to try out someone selling stability? Larry Diamond, a professor at Stanford University, says the global track record might alarm you. Overall, Diamond found that 27 countries experienced a breakdown in democracy between 2000 and 2015. Yesterday, for instance, the Turkish government detained top leaders of the opposition party, effectively removing any checks in power for what was considered a bastion of democracy in the Middle East. Diamond says, during this period, authoritarian governments have been emboldened.
We've been in a global recession of freedom and democracy in the world. Going back 10 years, it's been a relatively mild one. But in the last 2 to 3 years, with the setbacks to democracy in crucial countries, Thailand, Turkey, now you see this thug and autocrat has been elected in the Philippines, it's been gathering steam.
Jenny Mansbridge is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School and author of Beyond Adversary Democracy. Mansbridge says some of the same forces are at work in our own democracy, but we also have some very robust safeguards.
It's not too bad for our country. We have a long history of democracy. The American people are very committed to democracy, so we can withstand a great deal. two things are toxic. One is the language that people are using and the anger that people are feeling. But the other thing that's toxic is kind of deeper and more structural, which is that our parties have pulled apart for perfectly understandable reasons, and we're going to have to get used to a form of doing democracy that we're not used to in the United States and that the system was never set up to handle.
What do you think are the underlying forces that make it difficult to determine what the mainstream is all about?
One is inequality. As I think lots of people know now, inequality is back to the level that it was in the Gilded Age. We had a very high inequality when my parents used to take me down to see the Newport Mansions. And then we had the Depression and we had the war and we came out of the war in a very egalitarian space. We had high tax rates, the Eisenhower tax rates, that paid for a lot of infrastructure and a lot of good jobs. And that continued around until, the 60s, 70s, 80s. And then we started getting more unequal. And now we're right back to the Gilded Age again. We're right back to mansions and very, very massive inequality. And that tracks 100% the polarization.
In the kinds of outlying unpredictability we are seeing in the American election right now, are we looking at the kinds of really surprising question marks with unclear outcomes that characterize how the 20th century began as we look at the beginning now of the 21st century and the turbulence that we're feeling now?
Well, I may know a bit about history, but I'm not necessarily a clairvoyant. So I would say that we're not having a war. War changes things tremendously. So I don't see anything comparable to what went on in World War I or World War II upsetting the situation here. But we do have the possibility of one of the parties restructuring dramatically. I'm not sure that will happen. We have a lot of anger, and that anger sometimes produces dramatic restructuring, not always. So, yeah, I think we'll see some changes, but I'm not sure that we're going to see anything that'll shake our foundations.
Some politicians describe the turbulence that we're feeling in 2016 as a sign of the strength of the system to deal with these kinds of things. Others say, no, it's actually underscored weaknesses in the things that we presume are strengths about the U.S. political system. How do you view this?
It's strong in that we're going to get through this. The country is not going to fall apart. The American people believe in democracy, and they're going to keep believing in democracy. It's weak in that the separation of powers that was set up in the 18th century to prevent anything happening that didn't get a consensus prevents lots of things happening that we need to have happen now, particularly in the circumstances that the founders did not predict. The founders did not expect political parties, and they wanted to design the Constitution precisely to prevent those, and that's what we've got today. So we do have a somewhat dysfunctional system. You notice no European country choosing a democracy has chosen the system that the U.S. has. So it's not a great system, but it's very, very much bolstered, very much strengthened by the fact that the American people are so dedicated to democracy. We're not going to see any dictators in the United States coming up soon.
Although in the language of the campaign, you've seen a discussion or a rise of nationalism, authoritarianism, the disenchantment that you've described, are those here to stay, and are we on a path we can't turn back from?
We're not in a path we can't turn back from, but we ought to expect those feelings and the structures that create them to last way beyond the present election. It's not just the inequality that I mentioned that has that great U-curve that's exactly the same as polarization. That's one underlying cause. But another one is that Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act back in 1964. And since then, the Southern conservatives have left the Democratic Party. And that's meant that the Democratic Party has been more consistently liberal because it's lost its conservatives, and the Republican Party has become more social conservative. So you used to be you could talk about a conservative Democrat and a liberal Republican. Can't do that much anymore.
Jenny Mansbridge is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School and the author of Beyond Adversary Democracy. Jenny, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you right now about a fundamental threat to American democracy.
Now that takes me back. In 1979, President Jimmy Carter delivered his now famous Crisis of Confidence speech, a speech which branded him the bummer president of the 1970s and ironically set up Ronald Reagan to play the role of upbeat, everything's okay, morning in America guy in his movie star presidency of the 1980s. But Carter's original words about that loss of faith bear repeating.
Our people are losing that faith, not only in government itself, but in the ability as citizens to serve as the ultimate rulers and shapers of our democracy. We always believed that we were part of a great movement of humanity itself called democracy, involved in the search for freedom. And that belief has always strengthened us in our purpose. But just as we're losing our confidence in the future, we're also beginning to close the door on our past.
He said this almost 40 years ago. Somehow it doesn't feel that way.
The symptoms of this crisis of the American spirit are all around us. For the first time in the history of our country, a majority of our people believe that the next 5 years will be worse than the past 5 years. As you know, there is a growing disrespect for government and for churches and for schools, the news media, and other institutions. This is not a message of happiness or reassurance, but it is the truth, and it is a warning.
Former President Jimmy Carter, July 15th, 1979. Now, I just don't have the heart to leave you there heading into the election weekend. I wouldn't do that. I have given you something to think about, but here's another Carter voice, June Carter Cash, singing a real classic and a very different sentiment. Always on the sunny side. June, thanks.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life.
Our Turbulence Hour was produced by Oliver Lazarus and Amber Hall. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.